to CYC Podcast, Discussions on Child and Youth Care, episode number 87. I'm your host, Wolfgang Vachon. When thinking about the world of child and youth care, there are a few people who have made such major impacts that they become markers of epochs. Dr. Tom Garfat is one such person. To go over his CV would take up half of our interview time. He's an author, an editor, a teacher, a mentor, and a practitioner that has been contributing to CYC for several decades now. I'll post some links at cycpodcast.org for you to find out more information about him, should you choose. Hello, Tom, and thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thanks for having me. It's nice to be here. I really like what you're doing.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
So I'm happy to be a part of it.
Nice. I'm happy you're willing. I want to start with a little bit about you. You've been doing work with children and youth for many years now, and I'm curious, how did you come into the world of child and youth care?
Well, you know, like most people, it was an accident. Or maybe I should say, like most people back then, it was an accident, because people choose nowadays to do it. But I was going to university, and I was supporting myself by being a janitor in the local social service offices. And at night, I would empty the garbage cans and wash the floors. And there was this lady, Betty, who was the director of the child welfare place, social service office. And we used to have these wonderful conversations. You know, I'd be emptying the buckets, and we'd be talking about things like, how come some people in the world have different advantages than others? Or how come artists can't just live on their art, you know? And the kind of world that we lived in. Well, one day I'm washing the floor, and we're chatting like this, and I say, so Betty, how do you get to work with people? She says, oh, you go see my friend Lauren. And she sent me off to see Lauren, who ran the local, it was a shelter. They called it a reception and diagnostic center. And it was just this big old house up on a hill that had about 12 kids in it and a couple of staff that were called childcare workers. And, you know, I went to see Lauren, and he interviewed me. It kind of went like, so did you like kids? I was barely out of that age myself, so I said yes. You know, he said, have you ever been in trouble? And I'd been arrested when I was young, so I could answer positively. And he asked me if I'd ever done nothing, and I'd just come back from bumming around Europe for a year. So I said yes to that. So I'd answered all the questions really well. So I got hired. And that's kind of how we got hired back then, right? That and the fact that I was a guy, and of course everybody believed that kids needed to be wrestled to the ground.
Right, right. So and not just wrestled for fun.
No touching for fun.
No touching for fun, just wrestling for dominance.
Yeah.
So things really have changed since you first started. As you say, you know, it was sort of an accidental situation, and I sort of see myself in the same situation in many ways, sort of fell into this career by accident. And many people choose now. What are your thoughts about that change? And yeah, any thoughts about that shift?
Well, you know, people, it's common nowadays for people to talk about how, well, the big difference is we used to be all about behavior and authority and control. And people talk about how we've become more relationship-based and more recently relational. And that's all true. But I think the biggest shift that I've seen in the field since I started, which was like almost 50 years ago, is that people are actually thinking about what child and youth care is, and they're thinking about what we're doing, and they're thinking about how we're doing it. So I think for me, a big shift has been this whole emphasis on actually reflecting about what we're doing. Because, you know, we would wrestle kids to the ground because somebody said, whoa, take down. And we would just all, you know, march in like sheep. Or some external source would say to us, here's what you need to do with this kid. So we would just do it blindly without thinking. And nowadays, you know, if some external source came along and said, well, you know, you have to punish this girl or something, a CYC staff team would hopefully say, well, no, we don't do that. You know, we have a different way of working. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, we're thinking about it. We're finding a way to define what we do. We're starting to identify what we mean by our way of working with kids or our way of being with kids and families. So for me, that's been the biggest shift. Mm. And that's come about because of some fairly, I think, provocative thinkers in our field, like Jerry Fuster, you know, who's always a little bit on the edge, you know. And so people like him have, like, provoked us and pushed us to think about what it is that we're doing. And that continues today, you know, with the writers that we have today who are sometimes considered to be edgy, you know, like Karis Garbahi or, you know, Hans Gottmeier, kind of edgy people who are really pushing us to think hard. Mm-hmm. There's lots of people writing good stuff about, you know, reflecting and thinking and whatever. But I think the thing that helps us the most is those people who are on the edge. Hmm. You know,
what does that bring to child and youth care when we have people who are on the edge, who are provoking those ideas, those thoughts, who are pushing us into those uncomfortable places?
I think it it does just that. It pushes us into uncomfortable places. And so what's important about that is it helps us avoid becoming kind of sterile and static and habitualized. You know, because every person, every group, every team has a comfort level. And that's where people settle, you know. And once you're settled there, it's safe. And it's like a place that you don't want to move from because you don't know what's outside of it. But when somebody's really provocative and they force you to think, well, the problem with thinking is that once you've had a thought, it's hard to deny it. And so somebody provokes you and you walk away from a workshop or a training or whatever with one or two ideas that just got pushed. And what happens is they stick with you. And so you go back to work and somebody says, oh, you know, it's time to do this to this kid. And maybe that thought just lingers enough for you to go, well, wait a minute, maybe there's an alternative. So I think what they do is they force us to come up with alternatives, alternative ways of thinking, because now we're uncomfortable and we have to get comfortable again. So we go ahead and we try this new thing or think about things differently. And eventually it becomes part of who we are and how we are. So I'm really grateful for those folks, because without folks like that, I probably would have stayed in a static place myself, you know.
Mm-hmm. You would be the most philosophical janitor out there.
Yeah.
I don't know. Right. There's some pretty philosophical janitors that I've met over the years, though.
That's right. Or a damn good behaviorist.
Perish the thought. What? You're talking about some of the new writers, provocative writers, some older writers like Jerry Fuster, who's been on this show. For those of you who are interested in his work, you can look back at some of our past episodes. Are there any historical writers that you think have been lost that maybe we should reread at this
God,
juncture?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I remember when I was giving this talk at the first International Child Care Conference in Vancouver, and I was talking about Fritz Rettl, who, you know, wrote those wonderful books all those years ago. And I'm talking about it, and this person who was teaching at an academic institution came up to me afterwards and said, oh, Fritz Rettl, yeah, I remember reading about him years ago, but we don't talk about him anymore, you know? And yet, he's like so much the foundation of what we do, isn't he? Mm-hmm. I mean, out of him came, you know, the life space interviews and all the whole concern about life space. Out of his work came the notion that the people who do the everyday work are the most important person in helping a young person to change. So there's people like him, Henry Meyer, from the United States, you know, who wrote Developmental Child Care. Well, I got the title wrong, but somebody can correct it. But who wrote that book all those years ago and who was such a mentor for all of us. You know, you would go to Henry's workshop back when he was only, you know, 60 or so or 65. And you'd go in there and here'd be this little guy sitting on the floor looking kind of like Einstein with his hair out all over his head, blowing up balloons. And as you came into the room, he would blow up a balloon and he would bat it at you. And then you would bat it back, and then he would bat it back at you. And all of a sudden, the balloons, there would be all over the room balloons being batted around by people. And so here's this guy sitting on the floor talking to us about real engagement through how he was. So he took simple little things and made them powerful and meaningful. So when we talk about things like today, like making moments meaningful, it's people like Meyer who set the foundation for that kind of stuff. And we have a tendency to let those people go. Now, we can go back farther, and somewhere on CYCNet, there's a short editorial or something I wrote about reflecting on history. And, you know, August Acorn, you know, like, hello, mm-hmm. a wayward youth way back when. Konopka and writing about girls for the first time. So this is kind of... this foundation literature helps make today's, or helps today's literature make more sense. So when I read about Rettle talking about the importance of the everyday encounter, and I see the foundation, the context, how that grew up, and what it's compared to in his writing, it helps me understand today much better. When somebody talks about making a moment meaningful, I go, yeah, that's old. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody says this is such a young profession, and I go, I don't know. Like, 50 years isn't really young, you know? Mm-hmm. And let's go back farther. Let's go back 100 years. Let's go back to the orphanages and the crèches and, mm-hmm. you know, some of the people who were writing then. I remember reading this book written in, I think it was 1934, about the good house mother, you know, in an old model of care for children. And I read through that, and I say, so... here's somebody back then struggling with, how do I make this child's time with me more significant than it would have been otherwise? And yes, a lot of the stuff that we look at when we read that old literature was like routines and rituals and structure and stuff. But that's where we come from. Mm-hmm. That's our history. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's important, if you want to know who you are today as a young child and youth care worker, it's worth knowing your heritage. It's kind of like... I don't know, if your family came from another country and moved here, you'd want to know your history. Because mm-hmm. it's part of your identity.
Absolutely. And even knowing the history, you and I both live in Canada, but knowing the incredible history of Canada and the first peoples of Canada and then the mm-hmm. colonization and all of that and how that informs our practice. Many of the people you've mentioned, Americans or a lot of Europeans as well that you've mentioned, and I know that right now some of the most incredible CYC work is happening in other parts of the world. So in South Africa, there's the Izabindi Project. Other African countries are adopting that. Tuneel Islam and Leon Fulcher recently published a book called one of the first in a series of four books called Residential Care, Residential Child and Youth Care in a Developing World, which looks at just some unbelievable models of residential care in other parts of the world outside of Europe and North America. What do you think those of us who live in the West, in the North, can learn from other parts of the world about how to interact with children and youth?
You know, I was just... I just finished editing an article that we're going to publish on CYC Online on in the December issue. Mm-hmm. And it's about a model of family care from India. And by family care, they talk about young people living together in a household that would have like 15 people in it. You know, different kids from different places. And it's based on what they call the Indian family model, where extended family has lived together for long periods of time. So what they did was, rather than going the route that we've gone of getting like smaller and smaller and smaller, they stuck with this large scale family model. And, you know, from what I read, it's working really well. Well, I was reading this. You know, I read it first through my North American eyes, like, whoa, big groups of 15. That's like the old orphanage kind of thing, you know. That was my North American Eurocentric kind of thinking. And then as I read it and it got explained to me, I realized like how culturally relevant it was, that they had built a program that was based on their cultural values and beliefs. And that's what's going on with the Izabindi projects. You know, they have a set of cultural values, child and youth care integrated with, you know, local values, meeting people where they're at in the real sense of the word, you know. And so what I think we're seeing in some of this stuff that we're finally being exposed to from very different cultural approaches than ours is we're seeing that in some ways we're terribly generic. You know, like I went to work up north for a while with the Cree of Northern Quebec, and they had residential programs that weren't working very well. Anyways, after we'd worked together for a while, you know, a few months, I started to realize that what has happened was, you know, we, the Canadian government, had, or the Quebec government, had taken a very kind of North American model of residential care and just shipped it up north without trying to make any sort of adaptation to the culture of the north. Well, you know, over a period of about 5 or 6 years, as we slowly started to change things, we found ways to adopt the best of their culture in terms of raising kids and helping troubled kids with the best of what we knew about kids from the South. And so we got this kind of nicely blended model. So, for example, when I first went up there, and if a young person was having a great deal of trouble, they would send him down south to a secure residential environment. Well, by the time we were finished, if a young person was having severe struggles, they would send them off into the bush with an elder and a childcare worker for long periods of time. And the young person would come back more balanced than they would when they'd gone down south to these kind of locked facilities that are run on, you know, our kind of model. So I think what we're learning from all this is that there is so much room for us to do things differently. And by that, I mean, I don't care whether it's in a specific part of town, you know, where a particular cultural group is more dominant than in other parts, or if it's in a part of the country where the values are different. Because, you know, I mean, if you look at the values of, oh, I don't know, British Columbia in general, you know, compared to the values of Manitoba, maybe there's some really serious differences here that we have to look at in terms of how we do what we do. Not necessarily the focus of it, you know, the self and the caring and the loving and all that, but just how do we do this in a different culture? And it's been, I'm really quite enjoying getting exposed to so much more information and understanding from other cultures.
Indeed. You've spent a lot of time working and writing and thinking about working with families, and you know, no matter where we live, anytime we go into a new family, we're entering into a new, perhaps we can call it subculture or microculture. You know, we're entering into a new world. How do we do that respectfully, whether it be, you know, me as someone who identifies as white, who reads white, you know, entering into, you know, First Nations community with all that history there, or me as somebody who's, you know, college educated, university educated, entering into a family that no one's gone to school, or me entering into a family because there's a crisis. How do we negotiate that space respectfully as CYCs?
Whenever I do family training, one of the questions that comes up is what do you do in that first visit? People are looking for, I don't know, some techniques or something. And I say, well, you know, the only way I can explain it to you is, imagine you live in a neighborhood for a while, and one of your neighbors moves out and somebody new moves in. So now there's this new person in your neighborhood. And if you're like me, you're really curious about who they are, you know? And so you arrange somehow to make a connect with them. You know, it might be, you know, in the old days, my mother would have taken them a pie, right? But you make some arrangement to connect with them, and you're connecting with them around your curiosity. And so I think that anytime we go into any house, I say to people, pretend you're having tea with a new neighbor. Be curious. And you know you don't want to be nosy, because the new neighbor won't like you if you're nosy, but they won't mind your curiosity. And curiosity shows that you're genuinely interested in somebody. And if you position yourself according to a child and youth care approach, we're going to talk about things like letting them guide you, asking them, essentially, to help you understand who they are, how they make sense of things, what things mean to them. And so I think that if we can position ourselves around curiosity, having tea, being a student of this family, which does not mean you won't be a leader in the change process, but being a student of that particular family, I think, allows you to position yourself in a way that's... I think that if we position ourselves around, like, curiosity, that that's gonna be the best way to go, no matter who somebody is. When I first went up north to work with the Cree in Northern Quebec, I had a lot to learn, and this man, Roderick Petawabano, kind of became my cultural guide. And one day I'm on the telephone, you know, one of those speakerphone situations where there's half a dozen of you sitting around a table and connected to another dozen people out in various communities through the phone lines. And so I'm there being the expert consultant, because I've only been there for maybe, you know, a month. And I lean into the speakerphone, and I've said something, and I say to people, so what do you think about that? And there's like dead silence. You know, I wait a good 2 or 3 seconds, I'm sure, until I lean forward. And as I start to lean forward, because I'm going to ask them again, what do you think about that? So I'm leaning forward, and I go, what do you... And Roderick puts his hand on my shoulder, and he says, Tom, you ask them to think. Give them time to do so. And, you know, it was such a small thing. But in my culture, I expect everybody to answer immediately when I ask a question like, what do you think? And in his part of that culture, when you ask somebody, what do you think, they actually thought about it before they answered. And so we have, like, so many little things to learn about every family and every culture that we work with, that if we don't position ourselves as a student, we will just blunder along being the typical social service worker, white European worker, whatever it happens to be. And what will happen is we'll kind of like miss the boat. We'll be like ships that pass in the night. And we'll never be engaged in an in-between, a co-created us working together. We'll end up being positioned on the outside, trying to do to the system that we call the family. So I think curiosity gets us in.
I think you capture this idea of what it means to be relational and that in those examples you just shared. We often talk about, you know, relational practices, and people come and be like, well, what is that? Like, how do you define it? You know, to start where you started, you know, what are the techniques that I can use to be relational? And, mm-hmm. and I think you really captured what it means in a much broader sense than just the techniques in those stories.
Yeah, well, yeah, I want to talk about this word relational for a minute, if we can.
Please.
Because it's kind of like our new catchword, isn't it? Mm-hmm. We've only been using this word relational for a few years. Up until then, we talked about relationship-based work. You know, so our goal was to form a relationship with kids, right? So even back in 68, the other 23 hours, mm-hmm. Larry Brentrow wrote a chapter called Relationship Beachheads. And in it, he said something like the goal of the childcare worker is to establish a relationship with the young person such that he becomes significant enough to the young person that he can use the relationship to manipulate the young person to conform to expectations. So it was... The relationship based meant we formed a relationship with a young person, which allowed us to have power to control the young person. In essence, it was a vehicle of social control, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. So Now, Larry would never say that today, you know, and he forgives me every time he hears me quote him on this. But that's where we were back then, right? So we went along being like relationship based, and then we moved to define the difference between a good relationship, which meant the kids did what I was told them to do, or they didn't give me a headache when I went to work at the group home. So we moved from that kind of way of thinking about relationship to what we then decided to call the therapeutic relationship. And that's where more equality started to seek into, I think, started to seek into our work and our discussions about working with kids, because we agreed that a therapeutic relationship was a co-created kind of thing. Raymond Peterson talked about it as co-created experiences. And that was sort of like back in the 80s by now. And we kept along that route. And then over a few years, the idea that we were relational started to emerge. And yet we haven't been able to define yet, I think, what we mean by relational practice. So we talk about relational child and youth care practice these days. And, you know, Jack Phelan talks about it in terms of, Jack says you can't work relationally with someone in the first year of your work because you aren't feeling secure and safe enough yet yourself. Now, Jack and I disagree about this, and we disagree nicely about it. As a matter of fact, we had a wonderful argument in Thunder Bay you were referring to earlier, where we were just sitting around in a group, and Jack was telling us what he thought working relationally meant, and I told him what I thought working relationally meant, and we both agreed that the other person was wrong. and then about a month later, we exchanged emails almost at the same time, where each of us said, you know, I've been thinking about what you said, and you're right. So we went from each of us thinking the other person was wrong to each of us thinking the other person was right. Well, that tells me we're at a very important evolutionary stage in terms of defining what we mean by relational practice. And so my concern is that if we just keep using the word, as people are doing all over the place, without adequately defining it, we're going to end up saying that whatever we do, if we want to call it, is relational practice. Without necessarily having a framework for what we mean. And you see, I think relational practice means that we're always paying attention to the question, something like, how is what I am doing or thinking of doing, how is that likely to impact on the relationship that we have? So that my constant focus is on the relationship itself, more than it is even on the people in the relationship. So relational practice asks questions like, this in-between between us, this space that we're co-creating, is it a place of safety, for example? Or is it a place of learning? And then that raises the whole question of what we might call relational safety, which is kind of asking the question, do I, at this moment, in this relationship with this person, in this context, feel safe from harm? Because if I feel safe from harm, then I'm willing to take the risks. So you see, this conversation is about the relationship itself, as opposed to things like, well, going way back, using the relationship as a tool.
So what's the purpose of the relationship now? If the purpose was to manipulate, to control the young person, if the relationship shifted when we looked at a therapeutic process, and I would certainly argue, and perhaps not, this is not the time, perhaps, that not all relationships are therapeutic, nor should they be therapeutic. What is the purpose of the relationship at this point from your perspective?
I think it's to create a space that may be different than a young person has experienced before, where the young person feels safe to take the risk necessary to try something different, perhaps. It's to create a place where a young person feels valued, respected, cared for, significant, important, all those kinds of things. And, you know, in a way, I don't even care about other kind of outcomes like this behavior will change or that behavior will change. If this young person has an experience of being valued, that may be the most powerful thing that happens for them. And if they experience themselves as being valued in relationship with you, then perhaps there'll be a place for you to join together on some kind of journey or voyage to help him or her maybe find different ways to live in the world.
I often ask students, is relationship enough? Is it sufficient? We can all agree, or most people, everyone in the class agrees, perhaps because I'm the teacher and I tell them that's what they should think.
Which is totally appropriate.
That relationship is necessary for change, not necessarily for behavioral change, but certainly for I would say, child and youth care practice, relationship is necessary. But then I pose it to, is it sufficient? And it always causes such a great discussion in class around some people who are like, yeah, that's all you need. People who are like, absolutely not. There needs to be a purpose. There needs to be a reason for the relationship. And teasing that apart and trying to understand where we sit. And I really like how you there's me, there's you, and then there's the relationship, which is the co-created space. And I think that that's a beautiful way of understanding relationship. It's interdependent and separate from you and I.
If I was in your class and you asked if relationship was sufficient, I would ask, what do you mean by sufficient?
Nice.
Because Carol Stewart said a number of years ago, the relationship is the intervention, mm-hmm. period. Mm-hmm. Right? And then she went on to explain and stuff. But I still believe that nothing we ever do will be sufficient. Mm. Unless you could live with somebody their whole life, to help them continue the process of healing, which doesn't end at the age of 16 or 18 when they get kicked out. Nothing we will ever do will be sufficient, but it may be helpful. It may be a seed gets planted. It may be that, every time I've interviewed kids casually who have been in group care and said the group care was good for them, and I ask them, so what happened? None of them ever mentions the 12-week anger management program or, the control and power that you exercised over me when you wrestled me to the floor. They all start out with something like, there was this person. And then they go on to tell you about a person. And invariably, it was a person who just, whatever they did, help the young person feel that they were cared for and valued. And so here I am talking to these kids, years later, and they still remember this. They go back to it as something that was significant and meaningful and powerful for them. So, we can never, if you've been abused by the people who were supposed to love you for years and years, and you finally come into care at the age of 12, you're not going to get over that in 4 years, all right? So the relationship can be a foundation for the future, but it's nothing's ever going to be sufficient. Hmm. So I think all we can do is do the best we can to create an experience for a young person that helps them see, for example, in this case, that not all adults are abusive, that not all relationships are about pain, and help them have a different experience of relationships so that maybe they can search for something different in their lives than what they've experienced up to this point. And boy, that sounds like a philosophical janitor to me. Yeah.
Well, let me tell you, if I was a young person where you were working, I would be making lots of messes. Let me put it that way. So I'd have the opportunity to have you come and clean up behind me.
That's actually a nice analogy. You know, part of what we're doing, I think, is helping kids clean up behind them. You know, like, because their life has been such a mess, right? Yeah. But on the other hand, I don't want them to live in my grandmother's house, which was way too organized and way too neat and way too clean. And, you know,
absolutely.
I want them to live in a house that's messy and tolerable.
Yeah.
This concludes part one of Wolfgang's conversation with Dr. Tom Garfit. We will post the second half on Wednesday, December 28th, 2016. Thank you for listening.